the Buddha, how much is the Dharma, how much is the Sangha. Ramesh used to talk a lot about the necessity of having a kaleidoscopic mind. It's something that we can cultivate. It's also something that is given. I talked yesterday about the fact that in what you might call the logic of mysticism, someone actually wrote an academic paper called that once, which is interesting, the logic of mysticism. But as these things go, I think it was probably a good paper. I don't know how I heard of it. But whereas in ordinary logic, something can't be and not be at the same time, in mystical logic, that's not necessarily the case. Or something can have two seemingly different or opposing qualities. All is one and all is different. Not all is one or all is different. A good example of this. These seeming contradictions, of course, just really come from someone kind of running around in their head. It's not any contradiction to direct insight and intuition. Two aspects, two complementary aspects of one truth rather than two competing statements, one of which must be true, the other false. See, in what's called cultivating a kaleidoscopic mind, this becomes much more so, where different aspects show themselves. One aspect doesn't stand against another, and as long as you don't get your brain into it, that can work pretty good. It'd be very helpful. I want to show you another aspect of teaching in something we went over yesterday. River Master describes going into a temple on the hill and something happens in there. Within the temple there is the same representation of the cosmic Buddha with Shakyamuni Buddha smaller with it. And that's up on the altar. And in that part of this rather lengthy vision, Rim Master's in the temple and she has to close her eyes and something I just sit down on the floor. No one else seems to be in here, but that does not matter. My eyes insist on closing. I do not dare to look. Something comes and holds me and then passes on. When I can open my eyes again, I see that Shakyamuni is embracing the shadowy figure further on. There are other shadowy figures in the hall. I want to suggest that one of the meanings of this is that the shadowy hall is the hara. This kind of came up for me earlier this morning, and I just remember this term, the shadowy hall, which is one of the ways that the hara is described in the teachings on reharmonization. And I pinged, wait a minute, that was in that vision that we were talking about yesterday. So it got me to kind of look at it again in what you might say more internal way. So I just want to suggest another meaning for this. Think of the shadowy hall as the hara, as a place of stillness within ourselves. Think of the shadowy hall as the stillness, if you like, of meditation. Shadowy, you can think of shadowy as mean not, it means not, not clear to the intellect, not understood or graspable by the intellect, and yet intuitively known. That which we know, that which we sense, that which we recognize as being there, even though we have no explanation and no intellectual clarity on it. Therefore, shadowy. Think of the shadowy as shadowiness is indicative of the darkness of, is indicative of immense, infinite depth, infinite breadth. Out of that shadowiness can come anything from the eternal to help us. And then it can dissolve back into that shadowiness, into that darkness. There are times when the ahara is actually experienced in this way. Sometimes it's dark in this way with a deep sense of peace. Sometimes it's shot through with light. Light and dark and dark and light. Now think of the shadowy beings and the Shakyamuni Buddha embracing them. Think of each one of those beings as being one of the karmic jangles, something that in us, within us, which needs help. And think of the Shakyamuni Buddha as being the help from the eternal coming within the hara to meet that need. In other words, within the stillness of meditation, the help of the eternal is already there meeting the need. It so often is not recognized by us as such. That's why we need faith. You need to trust that when you meditate, the help is coming to meet the need and is meeting it there. This is of absolutely vital importance. Because this training is a very long, hard haul. H-A-U-L this time, not H-A-L-L, by the way. And a person can only do it if they have a deep faith. They trust the process that they cannot intellectually grasp and see and understand. They still trust the process. I look back on the years of my training, I see times when I simply had no way of understanding what it was I was going through or what it was I was about to go through. And I had to choose. I see times over and over again where, especially certain key times, when I really just had to choose to trust and keep putting one foot in front of the other, I had no idea what was coming. I only knew that I had to trust the training and to keep meditating. That works. And so many people take a few steps into it and then give up. And so often that giving up is just before the time when the help was going to really smack the need, dead center. That's so often when people bolt and run back to the preferring the devil they know to the devil they don't know. Run back to the world. Run back to the familiar. Even if they know the familiar is full of pain, still preferring the pain they know to the risk of the unknown. So many times I've seen that happen. So many times I've been on the edge of it myself, especially a few key times. Especially two key times. Especially two key times. Three, actually. It's interesting. Now that I think of it, one was very quiet. It's still the same thing again. Prudent Master goes on to say, leaving from where we left off yesterday, remember we left off where Shakyamuni Buddha was with great interest and care examining the state of the buds in the sea of lotuses. I like that. She says, I might as well go to morning service here in Shasta, so I go. We are reciting the names of the Buddhas and ancestors seated upon the haiseki, the bowing mat in front of the altar, because of course our master is celebrant. I see each one of the Buddhas and ancestors in turn, and I'm too awed to meditate deeper, for I know they will actually appear and I will speak to them in this public place. Always embarrassing when you're speaking to something that most of the other people or maybe everyone there can't see, you see. Plus one doesn't want to disrupt the ceremony. She says, they are walking about. One is scratching his foot, one turns around, although he's talking to someone else, and says, ah, yes, as I recite his name. I realize that they are dressed as monks and that the rest of the people here wear highly colored clothing, including, I suspect, myself. The people here, she's two places at once, as it were. This is what happens with the visions. You know, that the visions, she described the vision as being, as it were, kind of superimposed on ordinary reality. And she's completely present in ordinary reality, what we think of as reality. You could argue, well, one isn't actually more real than the other. And that's actually a good point. They're both transitory. But she never lost her grounding in ordinary daily life. Indeed, at this time, you know, the Master was very active in the community at this time. So it doesn't say this, but she was giving a lot of help to a lot of people with a lot of karma coming up. She was completely grounded all this time. Completely grounded. Never lost her spiritual grounding. At the same time, she was being drawn deeply within, especially at particular times. She says, Yesterday I asked, what is next? And was told, you will know when the time comes. My purpose is to be a monk. That I know. I now realize how to be one. I must not wander around up here when there is nothing else to do and there is not a ceremony on. If there is no ceremony, I must make one. Thus I make the monk appear. Remember that previously in this particular chapter, Rinpoche Master talked about just kind of being there, enjoying where she was, the beauty of it, the peacefulness of it, you know, the exquisiteness of it. And, you know, that's okay up to a point, and then that's not okay anymore. While it is good to do, it is good to do. When it's no longer good to do, one needs to move on. And this is such an important part of following the eternal. Bliss is no proof. Bliss is in itself no proof that it is good to stay in bliss. So there's as much need to be checking with the eternal, to be asking at this time as any other time. So Rinpoche Master is really receiving and taking in a deep teaching and a very important teaching here. when it's good to move on, it's good to move on. The Reverend Master, of course, Reverend Master was magnificent at ceremonial. Ceremonial had a very deep meaning for Reverend Master. And she used to say that, what you're trying to do in a ceremony, you're doing the finest job you can of something. You're doing the finest job you can of something. That's how you make the ceremony. If cleaning the bathroom, you do the finest job you can of it. That's the ceremony. If vacuuming the floor, you do the finest job you can of it. Within the limits of the situation and the circumstances, by the way, you could make the finest job you can of it and never do anything else on any particular thing. And obviously that's, again, you have to move on. But the deeper end, the deeper meaning of doing the finest job you can with anything is doing it as your training. Doing it as an active meditation. Doing it within the context, within the protective context, I want to say, of the precepts. Within the refuge of the precepts. That's doing the finest job you can. That's making the monk appear, allowing the monk to appear within our daily life. Doing a ceremony and realizing that daily life is the ceremony of daily life is not the same as being ceremonious. We don't need to do it with a flourish. We don't need to gild the lily. It's just doing what needs to be done. Just doing that which needs to be done with a straightforward, an accepting, a compassionate heart, a grateful heart, above everything else. Our daily life is a daily life of gratitude. This morning here, Master goes on to say, this morning here I am calling to the ancestors saying, hey monk, how do I become a monk? I find myself grinning suddenly upon the Haisaki as I am watching the whole line go by. This is the right thing. I come to morning service. Whether anybody else comes is not my problem. I can walk around on the shore and enjoy the Buddha land if I wish to, or I can take the next step. How does one know when it's good to stay on the shore for a while and when it's good to take the next step? Listen. Listen. Listen to the heart. The heart knows. Trust your instinct and learn from the results of what you do, from the effects of what you do. No one gets it right all the time. Indeed, at the end of this next chapter, a master describes her making what she felt at the time. I don't know what the exact circumstances were. It was a serious mistake. No one's so enlightened. They're not still learning. And the process of learning means, trial and error and success and failure. Sometimes not getting it right and being willing to accept the fact, do sangha, and try again. The next chapter is called Ordination and Transmission. She says, a monk is studying my notes this morning. Clearly, Reverend Master is keeping notes at this point. He suddenly knows that the golden figure in the sky with the white-clad figure of Shakyamuni Buddha with it is an emanation of the cosmic Buddha. This is why it appears as old gold in color rather than bright gold. even heavenly beings cannot behold the brightness of the Lord of the house. So that which is seen in the Buddha land is his emanation. And you could say her emanation or its emanation. Because how could the eternal ever be any one aspect? How could it ever be limited to any one aspect? Now, clearly, that which is perceived, that which is seen, or that which is heard, has to be a kind of emanation, because simply by the act of seeing it, it's something and not something else. And the eternal is not something and not something else. The eternal is everything. So, whatever it is that we perceive, whatever it is, however glorious and magnificent, whether it be in this realm or another realm, it's always going to be just the tip of the iceberg relative to the eternal itself. The medieval Christians tried to explain this by speaking of God's transcendence and God's immanence, saying God is both transcendent and immanent. God's nature has an aspect which is transcendent, an aspect which is immanent. The transcendent aspect means greater than and more, always greater than and more than. That's transcendent. Always greater than and more than. The immanence means always within everything. Transcendent and immanent. Transcendent can also be taken to mean as other than. But I like to think of it as more, always more than. In other words, if you think of it, the other than is this, I am not God. That's the transcendent, viewed from my point of view. Transcendence of God viewed from my point of view is I am not God. God is greater than me, infinitely so. The immanence is there's nothing in me that is not of God. I am not the eternal. There's nothing in me that is not of the eternal. And so for all beings. And indeed, it's said in Christianity too, no man can see God and live. And when one experiences the water of the Spirit in its really powerful, one of its really powerful manifestations, you really realize this. That the eternal is just infinitely greater, and that love of the eternal could at any point just take you with it. Could just take you with it, and that is when your life, your physical life goes. Physical life goes. Of course, one day that is what happens. We surrender into it, it takes us, and the body returns to the earth. At that time, it's important we do not be frightened by that brightness, by that power, but know that it's just love. It is infinite love, and it's incapable of doing harm. It is only when we are judging ourselves that we are frightened of it, because we judge ourselves to be unworthy. says, the monk is told that the Buddhas do not wish the lotuses to come too close. The beings therein, in the waveless sea, must drink in the cosmic Buddha through his emanation, as the lotus blossoms of this world drink in the sun's rays, and take their knowledge and certainty of him back down their stems to this world for the good of all beings. Well, that may be, and all I can say is I'm always grateful for any recognition that I have of the eternal in any experience, in anything. And I'm always content with it. I'm always content with it. If you have a little taste of bliss, a little taste of ecstasy, and you long for more, you don't really fully appreciate what you've got at that moment. But if you can have whatever peace, contentment, experience of love, experience of gratitude, however you want to view it, I mean, there's so many different aspects of it. In whatever form that you have it, if you can simply be content with it and appreciative, then you both benefit from it and learn from it. And you allow the eternal, when you do that, you allow the eternal to help you have a more generous heart. It's like there's times when we get our heart open with a kind of like a nuclear bomb, and there's times when we get our open by just our heart open just by a little prying with the crowbar on it and open up a little crack. It doesn't matter. The magnitude doesn't matter. What matters is that we allow our heart to be open. We allow the love of the eternal to do its work in us. And that's why we keep going to that meditation hall. You know, what is it, you know, that is cried out? Someone cried out and wrote it down in the Litany of the Great Compassionate One, do the work within my heart. You'll see as we go on how important this contentment is that I'm speaking of, how vitally important it is that a person can be content and not demand or in the end even ask for more. I'm going to skip a little bit here, although I encourage people to read it. Where Master describes going on a kind of journey in this Buddha realm and being basically taken by another being, taken through the sky. Describes ascending to a place where they're golden beings and greeting them. And then greeting some more golden beings whom I know to be past Buddhas. And then going up again. Then she says, as I travel with this golden being, I can, as it were, see myself. And now the bright colors fall away together with my form. I see it and them constantly falling forward and dropping away from me as skins may be peeled from an onion. This is a beautiful way of describing something which is otherwise pretty well indescribable. All I can say is it's something that someone feels at such a time, whether one is having these particular visions, kinds of visions or not. It's something that someone feels at such a time is a kind of a shedding of the old self, as it were, like the layers of the successive layers of an onion, the shedding away of unrealities, a peeling away of the unrealities and leaving them behind. And a dissolving into, especially in deep meditation, deep samadhi, dissolving into this infinity of stillness. She asks, should I go higher? She says, I am told you should go back. You are needed. You can't stay in that state of formlessness. At least not while you're alive. You're always taken back to the realm of form. Later on, Rim Master, later on in How to Go to Lotus Blossom, Rim Master talks about going in and out. This is one way of describing it. The going in, being drawn deeply within, the externals falling away, the concern about the externals and the sense of their reality falling away, going to a deeper reality, being drawn into a deeper reality, to the realm of the eternal, rather than the realm of the transitory, and then going out again, being drawn back to ordinary daily life. River Master Mok again, remember in her diary she talks again and again about being drawn out into the ocean, pulled out into the ocean, as if on a tide, into the ocean, and then deposited back upon the shore later on. See, there's different ways of describing the same thing. Different ways of describing the same thing. And different people will experience it in different ways. But the essential thing that's being described is the same thing. Because it's reality, not a matter of opinion or imagination. When do you go back? You go back. You're deposited back on the shore when you're needed back on the shore. Back in ordinary daily life. She says, I return at once as the Lord requests and do that which it is my duty to do. I am told that my journey will continue as soon as I lie down. It is bedtime. I am absolutely exhausted. I can eat nothing. And that's very common experience of people going through this deep drawing in and then being pulled back out again. That the deep drawing in is all your energy draws within, as it were. To describe it as being absolutely exhausted is a bit misleading, because it's not so much exhaustion as you normally think of it as just a profound deep weakness of the outer body because all the energy is drawn deep within. And this is where the hara becomes very great, is experienced as being very great to the point of being infinitely great, as it were a window upon eternity and infinity. It's also very common for people at such times to their intake of food to really diminish. And there are many other symptoms at this point of many other kind of external symptoms of what is essentially spiritually happening here. I'm going to stop at this point with the narrative. I want to talk about something by a use of a kind of simple metaphor that came up. If you have a rear-wheel drive pickup and you have nothing in the back of the pickup, imagine you're in a rear-wheel drive pickup and pickup truck, and you have nothing in the back of it. There's no weight in the back of it. And imagine you're at the bottom of a long hill, very long hill, and it's the surface of the ground is very slick. Maybe it's muddy. Maybe there's some clay or something. There's no way you're going to get up that hill, no matter how hard you stomp on the pedal, on the gas. That's because I learned this years ago. The Abbey had a tremendously powerful pickup, and you got no traction unless you had a heavy weight in the back. You just touch that pedal. You just touch that pedal, the engine would roar. It's just the slightest goose, you know, this thing, it's big V8, you know, and the wheel would just spin. Had no purchase unless you had a bunch of weight in the back. So that pickup's going, no, it's not going up that hill, no matter how hard you stomp on the gas. You got to get some weight in the back so that you got some traction on the rear wheels. So the metaphor is real simple. It's that storming heaven in any form doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because a person's got to have enough genuine merit in the back of their truck to get some traction before they can go up the serious spiritual hill. And you got to, it takes time and patient effort and a lot of work on just unselfishness. A lot of training in unselfishness to make enough genuine merit to be a big weight in the back of that truck. And this is a cautionary note that I'm giving here for people who get too excited about the spiritual goodies that they might be able to get if they really bear down hard. The kind of effort we need in training is a nice, steady, gentle effort. Steady effort. Gentle effort. And effort. It does take effort. But if you go stomping on the throttle hard, stomping on the pedal hard, in an empty truck, you're just going to end up with your wheels digging into the mud. And you're going to splatter mud everywhere. And it's to know you're not going up the hill when you do that. Often people, this will happen, to some people anyway, where they just kind of get into where they're kind of digging up lots of karma, but going nowhere. And the only answer I know for that is just go back to ordinary daily life and do what needs to be done, and trust that just ordinary daily training will put enough weight in the back of the pickup that one day, with just a gentle foot on the throttle, it's going to start climbing that hill. Indeed, it does so right away, although it takes a while for us to be aware of it. It's interesting that back in 76, just after this, we're at the beginning of November, we're in the first week of November 76, just before the monks' retreat, which is just a few weeks later than this, that I tried a little storm in heaven back there. The Reverend Master let it go on for about a day or so, a day and a half or so. Then she came in, and I was sitting in the Kanzan shrine at the Abbey. And she came in, and she was very gentle. She said, "Look, friend, what you need to do is you need to just go back to your ordinary..." I was kind of sitting in a retreat, see. And she said, "You need to go back to your ordinary activity. Just, you know, pick up your hammer again," because I was working on I was working in construction. We were starting to build the ceremony hall, the Abbey. And she said, "Just go back and, you know, just trust. You know, it'll come. It'll come. But you're not going to get it by storming heaven." And, you know, she was really, really plugged in. And the thing is that even though I was very sincere and I was certainly very desperate at the time, the problem was that everything was kind of turning dark. My effort was a willful effort, and everything was turning dark. I was kind of sitting in that truck without enough weight in the back of it, and I had my foot on the gas full bore, and I was just digging myself in, and the mud was flying, and things were turning dark. So Rim Master kind of gently rescued me. He said, "Just trust." So I did exactly what she said. And it was a full effort, but it was a sane effort then. It was a grounded effort. And then 2 months later, I had my Kensho. But really, the Kensho was really starting then. And it's from that point that I started every morning service. I'd be saying morning service, I'd just be weeping through the whole of morning service. And then, because the heart now was really, you know, the Eternal is very good at hearing. The Eternal heard my cry for help. It's just, it wasn't going to work to sit there and keep yelling for help. I need to actually get out there and help myself too. You know, but the Eternal heard the cry for help. So the help started to come as soon as I took my foot off the gas, backed off to a normal position. Then some merit started to fill up the back of that truck rather fast then. It started to move. And I got a real lesson then at not grasping. I got a real lesson. Let it be. Trust. You got to go forward. Go forward in the darkness. You got to fly on faith. Go on faith. You've got to trust. Reverend Master Mokugan likes to quote Reverend Master telling her in 1985 when Reverend Master Mokugan did an extended retreat at Throssell. And Reverend Master told her, "You have to trust like you've never trusted before. You got to trust like you've never trusted before." And if there was ever a time since 1976 in the life of our Sangha when we have to trust that way, it's now. This is a time to trust like we've never trusted before. Do our meditation, do our daily training in an ordinary, grounded daily way, and trust. No one's got to be Superman or Superwoman. Just have to be ordinary people doing the best we can. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha.